Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program takes you to milk.
All over the place.
And eggs. And one non-milk.
Yeah, so we called it dairy.
Dairy is one.
Well, we're starting out with some really rather fascinating dairy and a story all about a large animal.
The buffalo.
And who knew there were millions of buffalo in the country of Colombia? Well, we're about to find out how that happened and what's being done about it now.
Well, we're doing a little international communication here. We're talking to Alexa Marina Bell, who is in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we're talking to the co-founder of the Boof Company, Boof Creamery, Alejandro Gomez Torres. Does that sound good, Alejandro? Hello?
Yeah, that sounds perfect. You're rolling your R's. Yeah.
So, but we have this love for water buffalo from Italy, you know, where they have all the, because we never could find any of the water buffaloes. They were hidden, they said. The buffaloes hid in trees. I don't know where they were.
No, you're getting that mixed up.
Anyhow, Let's say that you have these wonderful...
Let's get that story, because it's different.
Yeah, let's try your story again, Alejandro, about how you ended up going to school in Virginia and connecting with a co-founder. Tell us your story of the company, Boof Creamery.
So basically, yeah, when I graduated from college in Cornell in upstate New York,
okay,
I decided that, born and raised Colombian out of a farming family, I was bored of having to take the price on things produced in the farm. So if we were having to sell cattle or grow rice or do anything, there was no real difference. It was something that wasn't interesting for me. So after I came out of college, I started to see differentiation and the opportunity of selling products to a special niche. So Virginia was my starting point with an organic beef farm called Brookview Farm. I learned a lot about organic farming, and that was 2001. So I came back to Colombia and decided that I should be doing something related to export and something with adding value to the Colombian countryside. And that's how we got connected with Luis and Roberto and Juan Manuel and Catalina, who are my partners actually here in Colombia. They had buffaloes, and they had the big problem that was a fortune for us, because they had too many buffaloes and too many female buffaloes.
Really?
So when we were there gathered, where Alexa was this last week at that farm, under that thatched roof, we said, what do we do? And I said, just out of nowhere, I said, we should make mozzarella.
Uh-huh.
Obviously this was after a bottle of wine or so, and it sounded beautiful. And we decided, why not? And let's export this, and it would be perfect. So it took us 6 years to have clean milk and to have good cheese. And then I connected back with my friend in Virginia from the organic beef farm, and my neighbor at the farm there was Chip Bosnick, and he was starting also a salumi company and a cured meat company called Oli Salumeria. I ended up sharing some of my samples of cheese with some of his salami on great pizza in his wood-fired oven, and he said, wow, this is like a great combination. Why don't we start Boof?
Yeah.
He started Boof in Virginia. My wife went to school, and here we are.
Well, his product is very good. We've interviewed them and sampled their product, too.
Yeah, his product is really terrific.
Ollie, you're talking.
Ollie, yes. Ollie.
You mean Ollie, the Ollie
yes,
product?
Yeah,
yes,
Ollie's
yes, yes, we know them well.
I'm interested.
Yeah.
How did the buffalo get to Colombia in the first place?
So the government, back in 1920, the Colombian government wanted to develop the Pacific Coast.
Okay.
That was a logging paradise with natural natural mahogany and all that. So the only way to pull those trees out of the woods was with buffalo. So they imported some from Trinidad and started a buffalo herd to distribute buffaloes through that area.
Now, Alejandro, this is on the coast near Cartagena?
No, that's the Caribbean coast. That's the northern coast.
Oh, this is the other side. Okay.
Right. So it's rainy. It rains about 9,000 millimeters a year. It's crazy humid. And steer and mules work because it was too humid and too wet. So their feet will be spoiled, and it was really hard. So buffaloes became an alternative. And then buffaloes were moved into the central part of Colombia for lands that were floodable. And people started buying buffaloes and breeding buffaloes because they could survive and thrive in areas with a lot of swamp and rain where cattle wouldn't thrive. And then just buffaloes started to be just disseminated all over the country. And I think actually in Colombia there's a million heads of buffalo total in the country.
Talk about not knowing anything.
Yeah, I know nothing about this whole development.
This is absolutely amazing, very surprising to us, because our first contact with water buffalo was in Italy, in the area just south of the city of Naples, which is very famous for its buffalo mozzarella. But the funny part about it is we never saw any buffalo.
That was a story I was trying to tell. They told us they were there. We couldn't see them.
Well, we discovered later on a different drive through the same territory that the reason we didn't see them is that they were kept in sheds with roofs protecting them, presumably protecting them from the sun. I'm really not sure. So they were there all the time, but you had to look in the right place to see them.
Right. Now, yours are all grass-fed, which I think is important. Right?
Well, I didn't know the importance of grass-fed until I went back to the U.S. and discovered, to my amusement, that being grass-fed was unheard of. And for me, born in Colombia, the only thing you feed to animals who ruminate or that ruminate is grass. So,
yes.
Our farms are just open extensions with grass. And we never have confinement. We have never had money to put up a barn or put animals indoors and control temperature and have to wash the floor and robots to have scrubbers. That for us is for humans. So it was basic, and that's how our operation works. It's a basic open range with rotations of different pastures where buffaloes are in their best habitat in the tropics, as opposed to Italy, where they're in temperate climates with winter and fall and spring. We don't have those. We just have rainy or dry. And buffaloes look for the shade, maybe go for a swim, and spend time together.
Interesting. Now, everything is done from the grazing to the making of the mozzarella products. He's all done in Colombia. But then you ship everything to the United States?
Correct. We make everything in Colombia. We have our buffaloes, all our from the same system that I'm describing with grass. We make everything here. We package. All the final product is done here, and then it gets shipped to either Miami or Los Angeles, and from there we truck it to wherever it needs to go. And that's how it gets fresh. It's Miami from Bogota is 3 hours and 20 minutes away. So basically we're overnight in the U.S. And ready to ship within another day after customs and all that. And it'll be in Richmond within 4 days of fabrication, for example.
Now, go through the product line, because it's more than just mozzarella, but let me make sure everyone understands exactly what choices they have when they're buying Boof.
So Boof dedicates itself to products that give value to buffalo milk. We have tried many different products, but we decided to stick with mozzarella, ricotta, burrata, and yogurt.
You have yogurt too. I didn't see any of that. I see. Yeah,
it's an amazing product. Really tasty, nutritious. Only two ingredients or three when it has, you know, fruit in it. That's where buffalo milk really shows its attributes. We've done other products. We've tried many other common dairy and aged cheeses and stuff, but for us, the product line is simple: mozzarella, ricotta, burrata, and yogurt.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've not had the yogurt, but all the other products are really, they're really wonderful. I have one issue. It's the packaging. It's very hard to open these containers.
This is especially true if you just had your nails
the
done.
Solution is already there.
Well, I mean.
No, I'm glad to say the solution is already there. We have a new package that doesn't require the foil that seals the pack, so it's a special lid that pops open, and then you can reseal if you want. It doesn't include that foil that's so annoying to open up.
It is. Anne was worried about her fingernails.
Well, I cracked the parts of both thumbnails doing that. My manicurist was lecturing me about it, scolding me about it.
I'm so sorry. I'm sure when you eat the cheese, your nails will be stronger.
That's a good idea. Eat more of it. I love it.
Yeah, eat more burrata. Eat more mozzarella. Well, this is just a fascinating story. Talk about something you didn't know about.
Yeah.
I mean, we already were worried about the fact that Italy made lots of mozzarella, but they had no buffalo because we couldn't see them. now we're dealing with a country we didn't know had millions of buffalo.
Your website, what is that, boofcreamery.com?
Yes, boofcreamery.com. We're also on Instagram at Booth Creamery, and that's where you can find us, and you can find us everywhere else in the stores.
And you can order from there, Alexa?
Currently, you cannot order off of the website currently, but we're in Whole Foods nationwide.
Oh, great, okay, super.
Where exactly do you live?
We live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, okay. There may be, I don't know if you're familiar with Mom's Organic Market. We're in all of their locations, which I believe one just opened up in Pennsylvania.
This show goes out globally, so it doesn't matter. It's internet-based.
But for my purpose, the local Whole Foods is less than half a mile away.
Yeah, but so Whole Foods is a major outlet for you. Great. So you're going to stick with these products. And just perfect it, right?
That is the plan. Of course, you know, they're trying out new recipes, so you never know, something new could come up, but currently right now we're sticking to our hits.
Well, that makes sense. If you're dealing with buffalo milk, this is what you make, right? I guess there's cheese.
Highlight. Ice cream.
Ice cream? that'd be good. Ice cream would be good.
But ice cream requires no additions. Yeah, there's no required cream added or anything. It's just ready to be ice cream. So we might go into the frozen at some point, but for now we're sticking with those products.
Well,
we find those products kind of highlight the freshness of our milk the best. Uh-huh. I know Alejandro had experimented with smoked mozzarella, but really tasted the purity and the creaminess of the milk. We find these to be the best for it right now.
Right. I noticed a difference in freshness, actually. I mean, it's pronounced.
A lot of people report that. We actually also just, I don't know if you know, we won a few prizes.
Well, that's how I wanted you to mention those because that's how we discovered you is the American Cheese Society Awards.
Yes. We were very proud and everyone in Colombia was incredibly excited. this past one in Denver, we brought home two for our burrata and the ricotta, and then last year we got first place for our mozzarella. So, you know, people are enjoying our product.
Yes, well, that's a very, very large competition, and to take home an award from that is indeed a prize. So you'd be congratulated on that, and I think it was well-deserved.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And let us know when you're giving a farm tour, Alejandro.
Yeah, you can.
Well, you won't want to miss
that. I have the horses saddled up.
Yeah, you can say hello to your old boyfriend.
I have the horses saddled up here, and it's something that you would not be able to imagine. That's what the reality of how our farms work. It's you can tell the story. You can next time we go and we show videos, and people are like, "Oh, how cute!" But when you're up there and you're looking at the bufalas and you feel, you know, their smell, their patience, them ruminating, it's just out of this world. It's beautiful.
It's an amazing story. I'll bet there aren't many Cornell University graduates who have done something as exciting as you have. well done.
It is quite unique.
I'm sure we'll hear more about Boof in the future.
Thank you both.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time, Peter and Ann.
Thank you, Alexa, for putting it all together, too. And thank you, Alejandro.
Thank you all.
Okay.
And you're very welcome in Colombia. If you ever want to come back and get a Ruana and a sombrero, we'll tell you.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next friend, Elaine Kersova.
Okay, spit it out, dear.
Yeah, dear. She had a subject, a single subject, that she was really intent on exploring, and the more she got into it, the more and more she wanted to know, and boy, what a rich history it is.
And you'll be amazed. You just thought it was butter, or I can't believe it's not butter, or something like that. But it turns out it's a long and interesting story, right? Are you there? Hello?
Yes, I was about to say it's called butter.
Does it have a trailer title too?
A rich history.
There we go. Okay, so here we go.
Elaine Kersova. Is it Kosh or Kosova?
Kosrova.
Kosrova, which you just told us before was Persian. I had no idea. It was once a rare thing, but it's becoming a bit more common. A food historian. You study the whole history of single subject foods, right?
Yes. That's my interest primarily in the food world. Yes.
And this one is aptly entitled Butter, A Rich History.
Mm-hmm.
So we told you earlier that Peter and I were just absolutely zapped by the extensive detail and thoroughness of this book. I didn't know there was that much to know about butter.
Yeah, not many people know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very surprised, even just opening the table of contents. I have 10 chapters in the book, for instance, and only the last one, the 10th one, talks about butter in the culinary world and its value in the culinary world. But there are 9 chapters that really cover a scope of cultural aspects of butter, from religion and ritual to the margarine wars to nation building, politics, so many ways that butter has influenced our world or been impacted by the things that men and women do.
Now, is it possible to say who it was who actually invented butter in the first place?
It's really not, because it was a very, very, very long time ago. I mean, many thousands of years ago, well before there was any written recorded history. And what we do know, what we seem to be able to speculate on, is that the first butters were, in fact, not even cow's milk butters. They would have been made from sheep and goat's milk, because those animals were the first to be domesticated. So it's quite a different kind of butter that you had way back when it all began. And most likely, it started as an accident with milk, whole milk, inside a shepherd's sack, whether on his back or on the back of an animal, that got rocked back and forth for quite a long time on some journey. And lo and behold, he opened up the sack, and there was these beautiful morsels of fat.
Yeah,
that's the idea. That's what we think happened.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, it makes sense.
So somebody tried, rather than throw it away, they decided they would eat it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah. And they could cook with it, they could eat it, they could use it for waterproofing, they used it medicinally.
Yeah, that was funny, medicinally. I didn't know about the medicinal uses. Mm-hmm. What are they of butter?
Well, the Romans were the first to sort of document that, but as a salve, for any kind of wound, they used it for that.
Would keep out air, right, from touching,
yes.
What's the cactus I use?
Aloe.
Aloe vera?
Yeah.
Aloe, right. Like that. There's all kinds of little references to butter in the Roman documents. Some of the authors who wrote specifically about health. It's interesting because the Romans would not eat the butter. They associated it with barbarians. It was associated with the barbarians of the north Romans had their oil. They loved their oil.
Okay, and yeah, that's right.
The butter was not something you would eat, but again, they would use it as ointments and salves and for wounds and cuts, for childbirth, things like that.
But you found out all kinds of interesting things. I was amazed at how far butter exists across the world.
Yeah, you traveled how long?
Because you've got Bhutan, which is in the Himalaya mountain range, and there isn't the bride gets.
Oh yeah, that's funny.
The bride gets coated with butter for a certain period of time before the wedding.
And which is the bride?
That was in Ethiopia.
That's Ethiopia.
Yeah,
okay.
What you're talking about is the bride gets to grease the axle on the carriage, right?
that's in India. Yeah, all these kinds of wedding traditions that you find around the world. Yeah, I traveled on three continents for this book, and I did not get to Ethiopia or parts of Africa. I would have loved to, because there are traditions, for instance, in Morocco, old world traditions, where they take a cask of butter, it's usually in some ceramic container, and when a girl is born to the family, they bury it in the ground, and they let it ferment until she is to be married. And on her wedding day, it's brought out as this wonderful luxury, and it's highly fermented at this point.
Yeah,
there are some records of people tasting it, Westerners trying these things and saying that it didn't taste spoiled at all. It was almost more like eating a cheese.
Well, what talk about cultured butter? I mean, a lot of people don't realize that there are countries that specialize in cultured butter and what it is.
Yes, so cultured butter. It's interesting to note, first of all, that's what you wrote about, right?
I did write about that. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the article,
That's right. You would have, because it's making a comeback in
this
country. But for most of the history of butter, what existed was only cultured butter. Because to make butter required leaving the milk out for many hours, sometimes 20 to 36 hours, to allow the cream to rise to the top, and then the women would skim off the cream and use that to churn into butter. But during this time that the milk was set out and in ambient temperatures to rise, because there was no refrigeration, of course, the milk would naturally culture. So that means that the bacteria, the lactic bacteria that are naturally present everywhere, these are good bacteria, they're not bad, they would naturally collect in the milk and start to slightly ferment it. So you're moving towards something that would be like sour cream in that kind of product. So that's how most of the cream was until the invention of a cream separator came along. That was in the late 1800s. That allowed people to take milk and instantly, through this centrifugal force, that's how it operates, separate the fatty portion, the creamy portion, from the more liquid portion, and then they could instantly turn that into butter. So you had something called fresh cream that essentially never existed before the invention of the cream separator.
Mm-hmm.
So for most of the history of mankind, you had this cultured, slightly tangy butter.
Which I love.
And many countries still like that flavor. France in particular is well known for their cultured butters, and that's what many people prefer there. But in the West, little by little, it became much more economically efficient to make sweet cream butter from the farm, to not have a long waiting time for milk or cream to ferment.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually people became, after a certain time, they didn't have much choice. It became harder and harder to find a cultured butter, particularly in the States, but also in parts of Europe. You had to really seek it out. So we've basically been taught to like sweet cream butter because that's what serves the marketplace.
What is this dog on a treadmill? I think that's pretty funny, isn't it?
Well,
it's making the cream, right? It's making the butter.
Yeah, it's just operating the churn. You know, they used sheep, they used horses, they used dogs. If you had a lot of cream to churn, it was great to have an animal doing it because, you know, otherwise it was the poor women of the household generally doing it.
I thought it was interesting. You said that way back in history, the milkmaids used to go to the cows.
Yes, men weren't allowed to be near them. Why?
Well,
right.
The tough thing was they had to go out there and milk the
in all weather, right?
Get the milk exactly. and then carry it back. And it must have been pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Yes, that's why they had those yokes around their neck with the wooden bar around their neck. They could hang a pail on either
ooh,
side.
Yeah.
That's how they carried the milk back and forth. Yeah, they had a three-legged stool that was somehow better for milking, a three-legged stool.
Maybe you could rock
and
a
they would, they would carry it out to the fields. There were many, many farms that didn't have such a thing as a barn for their animals. Or if they did, it wasn't worth their time to bring all the animals back and forth, for milking. There was no point because there was no equipment.
Did you ever hear the joke about the Jewish man who was buttering his toast in the morning and it fell off his plate onto the floor and it landed butter side up? And he knew that was wrong because bread never fell butter side up for the working man. So he consulted rabbis all the way to the top rabbi in the whole world, and they decided that what had actually happened was not that the bread had landed butter side up, but that he had buttered his bread on the wrong side. And one of my favorite expressions, and this was in a TV series, probably 40 years ago, called The Plain Makers in Britain. And one of the characters said to one of the other characters, "I may be rancid butter, but at least I'm on your side of the bread."
Wow.
There's so much lore associated with butter.
There really is this lore in the Haig household.
Because
the Haig household got butter maybe three times a year until I was about age five.
He was in England during the rationing.
In wartime England, the thing you put on your bread was stalked margarine.
Remember that? Yes. That we used to get these things with a little capsule in the middle.
Yeah, I never saw that.
And you had to break the capsule, and it was like orange, and then you had to knead it into this white fatty stuff or whatever.
We never saw that. But the
that was strictly in the States because there was regulation. There was so much regulation to try to
get rid of
them. margarine production and make it less convenient and attractive to the consumer. And that was one way they did it, was making it this nuisance, you know, little capsule. Yeah, but so many people tell me that story as I've traveled around, you know, on my book tour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting how some of them really believe that by kneading in that little tube of color, they were making butter. That's what they were taught.
Well, I wasn't taught that. I mean, I grew up spending summers on my great uncle's dairy farm, so I knew that was not butter.
Yes,
but what I hated was before having to go, they kept all this dairy in the spring house, which was loaded with spidery things. I hated it.
Oh, of course, because it's damp and dark in there.
Yeah, it was awful. Tell us about the Irish bogs.
Mm, fascinating. So the Irish bogs turned out to be a great place for storing butter. And this was, again, way back before refrigeration, but as far back as 1,000 years or more, the Irish would put their butter in the bog. We think partly to preserve it because, again, the bog was acidic. There was no oxygen in there. It was temperate. It was a good medium for storing your butter. But people have found over 450 buried containers of butter. So they call them bog butter. And they range in age from, you know, just maybe 60 or 80 years old to as much as 1,000 years old. At the Butter Museum in Cork in Ireland, you can see 1,000-year-old bog butter on display.
See, I never knew there was a butter museum when we've been in Ireland about 3 times.
Well, we had trouble with Cork because of the traffic pattern was really awful.
It's a sweet little museum if you get back there. But what was fascinating on this subject, I discovered, which I hadn't read it anywhere until I got really into the research by archaeologists who were digging up the butters. They mapped out where all these different bog butters were found, and they can see that they were on these sacred ancestral boundary lines, and they believe that these butter samples were put there as offerings to the fairies, you know, to the elements, to the gods, to sort of keep, you know, make good fortune, to keep the bad energies away. And it really does make sense because butter was so valuable. For people to just store it and leave it really makes no sense. It was a very valuable product.
They were religious. But this, you talk also about the other thing that's fascinating. I mean, now you go to state fairs and you see these master butter carvers everywhere, but you trace it back to a religious function in Buddhism.
Yes, in Tibet particularly, because in ancient Tibet, even before Buddhism came to Tibet, they worshipped, the Tibetans had a pagan ritual of worship, and they would routinely take yak butter and carve it to make, you know, certain sculptures that were significant in their religion. But then when a Chinese princess came to Tibet to marry one of the kings, she brought Buddhism with her. And slowly, gradually, the butter sculptures began to change in form and color and size to honor her religion, to honor Buddhist traditions. And this was like 600 AD this happened. So since that time, it's been a constantly evolving art, really, this butter sculpture, to the point where they're now so intricate and
beautiful. I've watched them.
They're so masterful. Yeah, there's a film called Torma. Torma is the name of these butter sculptures. They're called Tormas, and they particularly refer to ones that are used for Buddhist practice.
Uh-huh.
So when the Buddhists are practicing, they always have a Torma on their altar, whether it's a small one, a magnificent one. It's part of what they have as their ritual objects. And the tradition is extraordinary now. I was able to meet with a Buddhist nun who did a film on the topic, and she shared, you know, a lot of her footage with me. It was really fascinating. But I will say that most of the butter sculptures today are not actually made with butter. At a time,
no,
they
have something
only
else
made
in
with
them.
Yak butter. Yeah, but now they're using some paraffin, some margarine. It's not quite as difficult. It's still intricate. It's beautiful work. But actually, working with actual butter that can melt in your hand is a lot harder.
Yeah.
Now,
yes,
the story of what they do at the Iowa State Fair where they carry the butter forward from year to year.
That must be
yes.
Wonderful.
but it's all,
yeah,
but it's all built
about
on,
how smelly it was.
But right. It's all built on a frame.
Yes.
So
right.
it's not even solid butter anyway. But I think one of the most interesting things, and you don't make this connection, but or maybe you do, and I just didn't see it, but I didn't realize that Ireland was such a great leader in the world, if you like, of butter.
I was thinking
it was all the product of Kerrygold marketing.
Oh no, Kerrygold. Way before Kerrygold.
But in fact, you do talk about sort of a major trading in butter going on in Cork.
Yeah, I talk about the Cork Butter Exchange, which was the biggest butter exchange in the world for, I think, about a century. Ireland was definitely a leader in the butter trade around the world. They were shipping to the southern hemisphere. Their butter was all over. But they eventually lost out to the Danish, who were really good businessmen. They came up with better packaging. They had less salt in their butter. You know, these early butters, 1800s, were heavily salted to preserve them. Yeah, and so eventually the quality of the Danish butter just got so good that the Irish lost the market.
They did the same with bacon, by the way, too.
Oh yeah,
did they?
The Danish. Yes, yeah. Even all over England, if you bought bacon in the years before the EU changed everything from a trading standpoint, but you would see the bacon on display, and it would say Danish bacon. As opposed to Canadian bacon, which is different anyway.
Totally different, right, yes.
Now, I think we would be remiss if we did not mention that you have, at the back of your book, you have recipes limited to butter recipes would be like, it's...
I hope they all
have cooking series.
I hope they all have butter in them.
Yeah. So.
Oh yeah.
but at any rate, you limit it to recipes that are butter is essentially characteristic of the recipe. Did I put that correctly?
Well, they get their character from butter primarily.
Right.
I mean, they can't really exist without butter.
That's what
of course,
you include.
You can put butter in so many things. And it'll be tasty, but this is kind of, I call it butter's greatest hits, really. It's a fairly small collection. I didn't want this to be a cookbook, but I felt that it was also appropriate to have these as part of butter's history. You know, French sauces.
Oh, sure.
And shortbread and things like that. They're part of butter's history for sure, on the table at least.
Do you have anything about butter tea in here?
I do.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought I read it here. Yeah.
Yes.
I've never had that. Have you?
Yeah. A Himalayan tradition. Yeah, I did have it when I was in Bhutan, and I was sort of bracing myself for the experience. I'll admit, because I'd read and heard so many people who'd been in that part of the world say, "Oh, butter tea is so disgusting."
Oh, really?
it's salty and it's rancid, but I was in the highlands in Bhutan. My husband and I had hiked up to camp beside the nomads who have their yaks way up in the high elevation. Because really my point was to see yak butter making. I wanted to, that was my essential mission was, okay, what is yak butter and how is it made and what is different about it? So as in the course of just being there with these people, they made butter tea all the time, and we had it every day that we were with them, and it was fine. I mean, it was fresh butter, of course, because they were making it right there. There was a little bit of salt that was strange, but I got used to it, and a little, nice frothy. What they do is they whip it. They sort of put a little stick in there and rub the stick between their hands to make a froth. So it's not like there's a slick of butter floating on the top. It's not like that at all. They have special, if they're making a lot of butter tea, say for a journey, they have special churns. They're these narrow churns. You wouldn't use them for churning butter, but it's the same idea where you have a plunger, you pump up and down, and that makes the butter tea, sort of emulsifies the butter, so it's part of really the tea.
Well, you know, we've only skimmed the surface of this book. Even though we've talked a while about it. I mean, you have butter judging and characteristics of different butters, and there's a whole chapter on molecular butter. I mean, it's just like
what did you do? I loved doing the research. It was fascinating.
I can't imagine what you're going to write about next, but you must let us know when you've decided and
come and talk about it.
Because you're good at being a real expert. Thank you so much for sharing.
It's Elaine Kushrova, and it's called Butter, A Rich History. Thanks, Elaine.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, our next subject sure sounds like it's dairy, but in fact it's really not. So let's listen to the story of Milkademia, which is really rather fascinating.
You know, one of my most favorite things, of all things, is macadamia nuts. I could go really totally crazy about that. And Jim Richards is the CEO of a company called Milkademia. And he supplied us with a new nut milk made of macadamia nuts that was just, it blows your mind. It's just so rich and good. Jim, you are a New Zealander, but it's macadamia nuts are native to the rainforests of Australia. How did you get connected with this product and how did you start this company?
I actually got connected through a discussion at a Christmas party. A person I used to work with a long time before had got associated with macadamias. He was extremely enthusiastic and excited, and he talked to me about an opportunity. I was in a position needing to take on a new opportunity, and so that's what I did.
What did you do before?
I used to make breakfast cereals.
Oh, really?
So most of my life was vegetarian meat substitutes and breakfast cereals. Yes, that's what I did.
Vegans would love this non animal product, right?
Yeah. Look, the fact that it's non-animal is a major driver. You know, we proudly and loudly declare it to be non-dairy because that is where consumers are going. You know, there's been a major shift in how people view food. They view it through a lens of a new set of values that include animal welfare, you know, is it earth-friendly, is it sustainable, and there's a big desire for it to be free from anything that's considered undesirable.
Right.
No.
You're right on trend with this, actually.
For our listeners who don't know, let's put a dot on the map that says where the heart of your operation is, because it turns out we've been there and we visited with one of your neighbors. The place is called Byron Bay and it's right on the border of New South Wales and Queensland. I think it might be in New South Wales, but I'm not sure.
Yes, it's still in New South Wales and it's right on the east coast of Australia.
It's really
beautiful,
funny.
Beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, when we went there, we went there from Queensland because we happened to be in Brisbane right before.
Oh, that's right.
We forgot that the time zones were different, so we charmingly arrived a whole hour late because we set off an hour late because we didn't realize Queensland was on a different time zone than Byron Bay, and it's really surprising because one's north of the other.
Exactly. I have done exactly the same, and to fairly important business meetings too.
Yeah, Jim, most people, when they think of macadamia nuts, they think of Hawaii, yet macadamia nuts trees grow naturally in Australia. How do they get to Hawaii?
There's a few legends around that. The one that I think is the most accurate is that a farmer from Hawaii took them back because he thought they grew really easily and he wanted to use them as windbreaks. And that was windbreaks around brown sugar and pineapple. But then these windbreaks, which they're actually not a good tree for windbreaks. They break themselves, so it's a very poor choice for windbreaks. But it was a really good choice once they found these nuts falling off. Hawaii has taken off, and in this part of the world is seen as the premier supplier of macadamias.
Now, you mentioned to us before we got on the air that there's a singular force, a singular market, if you like, that is totally driving the world demand for macadamia nuts.
The price is driving up the price of macadamia nuts.
The Chinese market is for macadamias is very, very significant. That's sort of happened in the last maybe 8 years, but it's been accelerating every year. Macadamia price has gone up every year for the last 10 years, and every year has been a new historical high. And that's on the back of such high demand out of China. So there's a lot of people in China eating an awful lot of macadamias, and that's making them even more rare and even more expensive.
Now, you explained how they marketed them. I thought that was interesting. Explain how they sell them in the shell and with the key.
Yes, they do. So the way that the Chinese like to eat all their nuts is still in the shell. There's a perception that means that they're fresh. But for macadamias, they take macadamias, they actually use a tiny saw, and they put a cut around two-thirds of the shell. They then cook them in a brine, and that brine is flavoured. They then dry it again, put in a bag with a little key. And so when the consumer gets it, they insert the key into the crack and turn it, the nut will pop open, the shell will pop open, they get the nut out and eat it. And that is absolutely the preferred way to consume any nut in China, is direct out of the shell.
Well, that's pretty genius, isn't it?
Oh, it is. They've become an important gift, weddings and things like that. From what I heard, they're actually the groom and the bride who will provide bags of macadamias as gifts to all their guests. So that's one way they're being consumed.
Now, you're on a different mission, because we found you through this nut milk product that you're trying to develop into another large market. I wonder where that could possibly be.
The U.S. is the market that we're mostly focused on at the moment.
That's what I meant. I was hoping our listeners would guess and get it wrong.
However, we'll be going to China as well. We currently sell in the U.S., Australia, Iceland, and Argentina. About to go into Chile as well.
There are specific characteristics to this. First of all nut butters have become popular because of the interest in avoiding animal products, right? So these are natural, the milk of all nut milks are vegan, and they also avoid that irritable lactose intolerance, right?
Yes, they do.
So is this, it tastes really good, that's number one. And the literature you sent says that the nuts in your milk are never roasted. You just sort of process them for the creaminess of the milk that comes out of them, right?
That's right. We most roast the nut to try and enhance the nut flavor. So, once an almond is roasted, for instance, well then it's got a very distinct flavor that's stronger than a raw. When we looked at the whole issue of macadamias and nut milk, we chose to go with raw. And so all we do is take raw macadamias, we grind them up into a very super fine paste, and that is the base for the milk. It means the oils are not denatured. It helps with the nutritional value of the milk, but mostly it helps with the taste. That very delicate and delicious raw macadamia taste is what makes milkadamia. We have four flavors. We have original, we have an unsweetened, and an unsweetened vanilla, and we also have one for, mostly for coffees, that we call Latte Dar. And Latte Dar is sold mostly into the cafe industry in the U.S.
All right. Now, we talked about sustainability, and you couldn't get more sustainable than these native trees, right?
That's right. That's part of what we really love about what we do. When the pioneers arrived in Australia, they unsheathed their axes and cleared the forest for farming, you know, dairy farming in the particular area we are.
Oh,
and
wow.
What we're doing now is taking the tree that developed right there, a native rainforest tree, and we are recoating the hills and valleys with trees, which feels like the right thing to be doing at this point.
Oh, yes, I would say.
In the Earth's history, yeah. So we're pleased about that. The other part of our business and our sustainability is that we have no irrigation systems in place on our farm. We're not force-feeding or extracting water from underground to keep our trees alive. Our trees are native rainforest trees in that very area. They're aligned with the climate and the season, and we are able to have very little human input other than pick up the nuts once they're ripe and drop on the ground. So we try and farm as naturally as we can, use owls for rodent control because macadamias will attract rodents.
Oh, yeah?
So most, you know, a lot of macadamia farms are basically ringed by various types of poison to try and keep those rodents out. We don't do any of that. We have a little pack of fox terriers during the day, and we've built a lot of owl nesting sites. It turns out that a nesting pair of owls can feed up to 3,800 rats in one breeding season, which is staggering.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we've heard of people in the wine grape business using owls and other birds of prey in the same way
that's right.
to keep the birds off the grapes.
Yeah,
I imagine they would, and it's so much better to do those natural controls than to be adding another layer of chemicals into our already exhausted landscape.
Well, you're a very environmentally aware person by nature.
Our farms, because the heart of our business is actually those farms, and we spend quite a bit of time there, it changes your perspective on everything. You know, we literally write poems when we leave that farm, and I've never written a poem about anything else in my life, but when we walk away from that farm, we are so caught up in the beauty of it all and how amazing it is, and also how delicate the whole thing is, how, you know, we're at some sort of point where we've got to make a choice one way or the other. And so from that, we've become more and more and more desirous of producing food in a way that is totally sustainable and, in fact, adds value to the planet rather than us just being another group of people who are extracting all the value we can. We're practicing a whole range of different farming techniques, but the measurement we have is, do we create more topsoil every year? You know, if we've added another half inch of topsoil or another layer of topsoil, then we're doing the planet a favour, well as producing this product. And interestingly enough, I think one of the things that's driving nut milk sales, and it's not just nut milk, but we're talking about nut milk, is our values have changed. You know, milk is produced very, very cheap. There's government subsidies and all sorts of other ways that when milk lands on a supermarket shelf, it's a cheap product. It's strange that people would step away from a cheap product and start purchasing something that costs more to do exactly the same. But I think that reflects that all of us, slowly, more and more of us, our values are changing. And we don't value cheap like we used to. What we value now is that it's artisan, that it's looking after the planet, and that it's adding value rather than just subtracting value. So this whole thing actually encourages me. I'm absolutely thrilled by consumers making the choice that they are. It gives me encouragement for the future, and we need it because we hear so much bad news.
Oh, please.
Yes. So much to be concerned about, you know, from corals to the ice, you know, everything seems to be heading in the wrong direction. But then you have this issue that en masse, you know, significant numbers of people are choosing to recognize that their dollars have value. You know, and there's really only one thing that industry listens to, and that is their bank account and their market share.
Yeah.
And if consumers start to say, we will only support products that are sustainable. Industry is going to have to be sustainable to keep their clients. And I think that's a great thing. I think it's happened sort of organically. We've all heard a lot and we've talked a lot, but happening on such a broad scale that something else is going on. There's something in our consciousness that's doing something good. I celebrate that. Milkadamia is a celebration of that too.
Well, where you are in Byron Bay is a beautiful part of the world. We know because we've been there. The only advice we would have for you if you're in the neighborhood is stay away from Surface Paradise, which is not beautiful. and it's just down the road. And
take your wellies.
I don't know whether we won't catch up with you one of these days over there, but we'll certainly try.
And
in the meantime, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
And your business ethics really are inspiring. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Thank you, Peter.
Right. And again, it's the product is Milkadamia, and it's a nut milk, and it's wonderful. All of its profiles are wonderful. Anyhow, thank you, Jim.
Cock, cock, is that a clue?
Yeah, I think it is. Cock-a-doodle-doo, except...
What animal makes a cluck, cluck, cluck?
Yeah, well, not a cock-a-doodle-doo.
No. Anyhow, we're talking still in the dairy vein, of course, carrying a step further. I don't know which one came first, but here we have a whole segment on a book called Fresh Eggs Daily,
which tells you just about everything you ever want to know about chickens
in your backyard.
Does this lady know about eggs and chickens? You bet.
Lisa Steele, I'm assuming that a lot of people are interested in raising chickens, or else you wouldn't have written a book, your book called Fresh Eggs Daily, Raising Happy, Healthy Chickens Naturally. There must be a market for this, right?
There is, it seems to have skipped a generation, so a lot of people that are getting into it didn't grow up with chickens, or maybe they had grandparents who raised them, but they need a little bit of hand-holding at the beginning to just kind of, you know, before they get their feet wet, to kind of know what to do and how to raise them.
Right. We live right in the city. I mean, we did have a neighbor who tried to raise piglets, but he got stopped by the city.
but you can do chickens.
We can do chickens, but they have to be set. The coop has to be set behind a house.
You have to have enough space.
Yeah.
And we have a friend whose daughter raises chickens.
Yeah, but she was in Arizona.
Well, she was in San Diego. She was at the San Diego Zoo for a while, right?
No.
So she knew a lot about.
You're talking
birds.
About Carlin?
Yeah, about birds and animals.
She worked with birds, okay, parrots.
Well, chickens were birds the last time I checked.
Yeah, I know, but not parrots. I mean, she worked with that parrot that could count and say the alphabet and everything.
Now, suppose I met you in an elevator and we engaged in a conversation and I asked you for a 30-second elevator speech on raising chickens. What would you say?
Oh, well, as you mentioned, you don't need a lot of space. They don't take up much more room than a family dog would. You can put them out in your backyard in a little coop, and they lay delicious eggs, which is kind of just a side benefit because I really just enjoy them for the entertainment value, and we consider them family pets, and they wander around our yard eating ticks and bugs, and, I mean, they're just funny and entertaining and super, super useful as far as pets go.
And they have personalities.
They do. Yes, they do.
You have a section there on predators, because I mean we live in the city, and I think the biggest thing of wild creatures are rats.
Well, and that's true. I mean, raccoons and hawks, and I mean there are your neighbor's dog. I mean, there's lots of predators even within cities, but rats can be a problem. You know, people who don't want chickens in their area complain about that and say the chickens will draw the rats, but really it's not true. It's the chicken feed. You know, so it won't draw rats any more than a bird feeder would. You know, and if you pick it up at night and keep it in closed containers and all that, rats shouldn't really be a problem.
Let's not talk about problems. I mean, let's talk about opportunities. I mean, there's so much information you've packed into this charming little book. I'm wondering, is there anything you think you left out?
you know, it's interesting because I wrote it now 4 years ago, I guess. So we were about 4 years into the chickens, and then it's now been 4 years. And, you know, if I could edit it, there are a couple little things that I would tweak and change. I mean, I'm always learning things and trying things and that. But I think for the most part, I still stand behind it, and it's basically how I do things. But the beauty of that is I also have a website where I do have current information, and it's much easier to change a blog post than it is a book, you know.
And go ahead. The blog site is?
It's www.fresheggsdaily.com. So it's super easy to remember. If you have the book in front of you, just remember Fresh Eggs Daily.
Now, there was something that I kind of missed along the way. Aren't there cocks involved in the process of producing eggs?
Yeah, I was just going to mention the roosters.
The roosters, okay.
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of them. You don't need them.
You don't.
Have your hens, no. The hens will lay eggs anyway.
The eggs won't be fertilized, yeah.
Right. But if you have, you know, 5 chickens in your backyard, you do not need a rooster. And if you do have a rooster, you're probably just going to annoy your neighbors.
Well, that's what I was going to say. When you talk about the neighbors being annoyed, that's what the complaints are usually about.
I do remember what someone told us once when we asked them the question, what do chickens become when they grow old, too old to lay eggs? And the answer was dinner.
You know, and that's interesting because the new generation of chicken keepers, they are looking at them as pets. So after, you know, 3 or 4 years when they don't lay eggs anymore, they're not about to, you know, just chop the heads off their kids' pets. So now they have these chickens in, like, this retirement home. You know, they're not getting any eggs. They can't kill the chickens. They can't get any more chickens. So it's a little bit of a conundrum now with this whole backyard chicken thing where on the farm, I mean, your grandmother, my grandmother, she would just go out and grab a chicken and that would be Sunday dinner, you know?
Right. Yeah, well, you know, of course, the problem for years was that all these people bought peeps for Easter for their kids. And then they grew into big chickens, and that was something that wasn't anticipated.
Oh, okay. Did that happen to you? Did you have any chickens at home?
No, I never
you
did.
Didn't have any
and, well, we didn't like the fact that they die, the chickens, number one.
Oh!
You know, not the chickens,
yeah.
The peeps. They die, the peeps.
I think they've actually outlawed that because it was a big problem. People were buying them like as Easter basket gifts,
yeah,
and
right.
I guess not thinking ahead that they were going to turn into a chicken, which, I mean, it's kind of like getting a kitten or puppy. Like, you kind of have to do your research and realize that, you know, this animal has a lifespan and you kind of have to commit to it.
Right. I mean, I have a friend that owns a parrot. In fact, the father of the girl that raised
the chickens.
He had to put it in his will because the birds are going to so outlive him.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Parrots live for...
Apparently, parrots last a long time.
Yeah.
A lot longer than chickens.
Right.
Well, let's just say very specifically that what your book is really talking about is how to raise the chickens naturally and healthfully. And so there are all these things in here about herbs, and I finally now understand about the birds in our backyard that come and use our bird bath. I understand why they fluff around in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. We thought they were dirty birds.
We thought they were just a nuisance because the place they always picked was the prime lettuce patch.
Nice. Yeah, chickens will do that. They like my herb garden.
Well, sparrows like that too, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's true. And, you know, you can incorporate a lot of herbs and natural things. I mean, we're eating their eggs, you know, medicated this or medicated that or antibiotic this. So, you know, I want to keep them healthy. And, you know, it's kind of like growing a garden. You don't want to throw pesticides all over it.
Right.
You're growing food so your family's healthier.
No, I'm absolutely amazed at how much information you gathered. There are answers to questions. There are answers to 150 questions I never would have even thought to ask.
Good. That's the point of it.
And you got that just by experience, sometimes painful experience, I'm guessing, huh?
There's a lot of studies. You know, anything herbal, really. There's not a lot of scientific studies. But, you know, a lot of watching my chickens, a lot of common sense, a lot of using herbs and thinking about how I use them in, you know, our family and our health. But mostly just watching the chickens. You know, they have these behaviors. And when you notice that they start eating parsley a lot, you go and look up what's up with parsley, and you find out it's packed with vitamins and nutrients, and you say, well, that must be healthy for them. You know, so it was a lot of that. But they're fascinating. They're fascinating little creatures.
It sounds like a lot of work, though, Lisa.
Oh, well, technically it's my job. So, I mean, you know, maybe I put a little more into it than you might have to. But I think if you give them the tools, I mean, I plant an herb garden for my chickens. So they can just come and go and nibble and eat what they want. And I try to make them self-sufficient. So it's not a lot of work for me once I have it all set up. You know, the startup is a bit much with the coop and the run and getting the chickens
like
and the chicks.
It's like getting a puppy. You've got to train the chicks.
Right. They make a huge mess, and they have to be in the house at first. And, I mean, it is a bit much. I mean, it is a commitment. And I think that people, it's good if they know that. And like you said, it's not just picking out a little pink or purple chick out of a bin for Easter, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's really cool. I mean, you explain about broody hens.
Yeah.
Which are the ones that decide they're going to hatch their chickens, and you're not going to eat the eggs after all. You want eggs for breakfast, you have to go somewhere else.
Yeah. They're wonderful if you do want to hatch baby chicks, but I mean, if you don't have a rooster, those eggs are never going to hatch anyway. So then you're just like pulling your hair out with this chicken who decides she wants to be a mom, and that's just not happening.
Well,
this is the most fun we've had since we interviewed the publicist in New York who decided to raise goats.
Oh, fun.
So we listen, we must be considerate because we know you've experienced some major weather problems in your part of the world recently, so and you're lucky just to get your phone service back. We hope you get the rest of your power back as soon as possible. And in the meantime, I guess the chicks are doing okay anyway because you prepared them for all this kind of stuff.
Okay. Right, yeah, we don't use electricity in the coop or anything, so they're fine. Yep, everything's fine.
So we're talking with Lisa Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E. Her book, Fresh Eggs Daily, which is a must if you've decided to raise chicks, or as we say in Australia, chooks.
Chooks don't produce eggs. Chooks are roasted. I can assure you.
Okay. Lisa, thanks for getting back to us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sweetheart, I think our listeners should feel particularly well educated today. If you didn't learn something today, you're a very smart cookie. And you'll be a smart cookie still, same time, same place next week when we'll be with you again. So until then,
bye-bye.